Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we did see shares of big tech kind of mixed today. Apple was lower, Amazon was higher. More than 20 tech and civil society leaders, including the CEOs of five of the 10 biggest U.S. companies, appeared at a closed-door Senate meeting today to shape how artificial intelligence is regulated. The meeting was organized by Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. It included a mix of personalities with diverging views on how to write the rules for AI. We're talking about people like the CEOs of Alphabet, Microsoft, Meta, and OpenAI, all invited to appear alongside rivals and industry critics to discuss possible guardrails for AI that balance the risks and rewards of this tech. Kaylee Lyons is the co-host of Bloomberg Sound On, weekdays at 1 p.m. Wall Street time, right here on Bloomberg Radio. She joins us from our Washington, D.C. bureau. And Anna Edgerton is technology reporter at Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. So, Anna, talk to us a little bit about what happened behind closed doors this afternoon.
Yeah, you know, it was a pretty crazy scene. We were able to go in at the beginning of the meeting, but then it was not open to the public. And there's a lot of complaints about that from senators like Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, saying, you know, we shouldn't be giving these tech CEOs the chance to basically lobby senators behind closed doors. But from talking to people who are actually in the room, they said, you know, it was mostly kind of surface level statements at the beginning, and then got into a more interesting discussion involving, you know, the security risks of open source research, you know, things about, like, should there be a new agency to regulate AI? So there was some substantive discussion, and it'll be interesting to see how that continues into the afternoon.
I want to bring you just quickly a red headline crossing the Bloomberg terminal right now. ARM, the chip designer whose IPO is being so closely watched by the market, according to Wall Street Journal, is set to price its IPO at $52 a share. That would give it a valuation of $55.5 billion a share, or $55.5 billion overall on a fully diluted basis. That's seemingly a little bit more than they were looking for initially, but roughly around the outline that they had given. But we'll bring you more on this story in just a few minutes. Guys, I want to understand from these discussions that happened today, what do you think, Kaylee, what do you think, if anything, will be the sort of policy implications going forward from these discussions?
Well, this really was just a start. That's what the organizer of the summit today, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, said. He would like to see many more of these summits. He would like to see committees in the Senate working up legislation. He said he would like to see AI regulation in a matter of months, not years. But what we know is that Congress is a pretty slow-moving body, and this technology is moving very quickly. So it's kind of a race here between policymakers who all seem to agree today that they do want to get their arms around this technology, that there is a role for the federal government to play in setting guardrails around it, and then actually doing so is going to be another story. So this was really just the beginning, and we'll see how things progress from here.
It was quite a crew in Washington today. Tech tycoons with a combined net worth of roughly $550 billion gathered in the same room Wednesday to talk about AI and how it's regulated. One of the people there was none other than Tesla CEO, ex CEO, SpaceX
is he still the CEO?
Guy.
Yeah.
I guess he's not ex-CEO. Yeah, that's a good point.
Owner.
Thank you. Ex-owner. Elon Musk. Check out what he had to say to reporters.
The reason that I've been such an advocate for AI safety in advance of sort of anything terrible happening is that I think the consequences of AI going wrong are severe. So we have to be proactive rather than reactive.
That was none other than Elon Musk saying that we have to be proactive rather than reactive regarding AI. Kaylee, this is not anything new that he said. I mean, he's been talking about the threat of AI for years. Mm-hmm. My question for you is, do lawmakers understand AI?
Excellent question, Tim. Well, part of today was framed as an educational effort. The reason they were having, as Anna said, what was a kind of controversial decision to have a closed-door meeting was that they wanted these people to be candid, knowing that you had more than 20 people there who were going to have about 3 minutes to speak, at least at the beginning. They were trying to get out as much information from them as they possibly could. Understanding is largely what they were seeking, in addition to, you know, potential guidance or ideas as to how to move forward on a regulatory basis. But this is the U.S. Senate we're talking about, guys. They're not necessarily the most technologically savvy individuals that are out there.
That's an understatement. It's so true.
Yeah, I think I've heard some discussions of theirs about the internet, and that's been around for a little while longer than some of this artificial technology. But Anna, are there any areas where, you know, the participants in this meeting that you understand from your sources, you know, came to some sort of agreement that maybe didn't exist before?
Yeah, two themes that kind of emerged from at least the executives in the room, if not kind of the civil society actors, were that the U.S. should play a role in setting kind of the global governance discussion about AI. There seemed to be, you know, broad agreement that the U.S. needs to have something to contribute to this discussion. If not in the form of legislation, then, you know, these voluntary commitments that the White House has been talking about, has secured from several companies. So, you know, that was one area of agreement. And then there was also kind of a broad understanding that regulation should focus on the end use of this technology, like how AI tools are used rather than the actual systems themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the civil society participants might have a differing view about that because, you know, these systems are going to be powerful in ways that we don't understand. So it's not like you just put cars on the road and let people use them as they will. You know, you regulate seatbelts, you regulate airbags. So, you know, what's the equivalent for AI? That's still going to be the task for Congress to kind of hash out.
One person who was there, Anna, who doesn't necessarily have the name recognition yet among a wide group of people, I would argue, is Sam Altman, the founder of OpenAI. And I'm wondering what you heard from him. He's definitely someone who I think we can, at this point, credit with shaping a lot of the interest that we've seen in AI since the launch of ChatGPT and since the interest around it.
You know, it was so interesting when he spoke to Congress several months ago because it was kind of the first time that this conversation really burst onto the scene on Capitol Hill. And you have this kind of boyish-looking, doe-eyed CEO very earnestly saying, we need to be regulated. You know, if AI goes wrong, it could go very wrong. And so you see this kind of plea from the CEO of this new innovative company that sounded very different than what we had heard from Mark Zuckerberg in hearings past. However, in the months since then, when it comes to actual regulation, like we're seeing in EU with their AI Act, we've heard pushback from Sam Altman. So, you know, he is kind of emerging as another CEO who wants to be regulated, so to speak, but only on his terms.
Yeah, Kaylee, you actually spoke to him on his way in, I think.
Yeah, I yelled at him as he was getting out of his SUV heading into the Russell Senate building. And I asked, you know, what are you planning to tell senators? What's your message in your opening remarks? And he says sort of that this is an important, urgent, and in some ways unprecedented moment. There was really kind of a theme here. It wasn't just Sam Altman, but Senator Chuck Schumer, others as well, everyone trying to convey a sense of urgency in trying to get something done in regard to AI. And part of that conversation I thought was really interesting was about competition with China, how you don't want to have the Chinese Communist Party being the ones that are setting the rules of the road and kind of the groundwork here, that the United States should be doing it. And it seemed like that kind of competitive drive was in part what is really driving a lot of the desire on the part of lawmakers to do something and do something quickly here. And this is something that we know the likes of Elon Musk raised in the hearing today as well.
Kaylee Lyons, co-host of Bloomberg Sound on weekdays at 1 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio from our Washington, D.C. bureau. Anna Edgerton, technology reporter at Bloomberg News on the phone from Washington, D.C. A big thank you to both of you for bringing us the latest from Washington and AI.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, it's the big news after hours, certainly, but perhaps the big news for tomorrow as well. Arm Holdings pricing its IPO at $52 per share. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. This is set to be the largest listing this year. It had intended to price $47 to $51 per share, but Bloomberg News had reported that the company was even looking to potentially exceed those valuations, and it does appear they have. This would put this price, according to Wall Street Journal sources, would put the overall valuation of the company at $55.5 billion, and it's, of course, set to start trading tomorrow. Here to break down the price, the IPO, and the IPO market is Janae Teer. She's the senior data editor at Crunchbase and joins us from Palo Alto to discuss. We just got this news, Janae. What are your thoughts here? Is this surprising to you that we kind of saw the pricing come in just ahead of the target?
I think over the last few days, there's been indications as the company has been doing its roadshow with institutional investors that there is a lot of interest in the ARM stock. They said 47 to 51, and they're pricing a little higher at 52, not too much higher. You know, I've seen reports of this is 5 to 10 times oversubscribed. So definitely a lot of investor interest. And I think, you know, as we've led into this month of three companies planning to IPO, three very strong companies, which we have not seen in the last 18 months. I think all the questions have been around what are the right valuations in the market. We've seen valuations come down massively in the last 18 months. And so where are these valuations going to sit? Is there investor interest? I think there have been a lot of questions around that. And I think it's certainly interesting to see that they're pricing a little higher than their guidance.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting to see that. And one thing that's also interesting to see is just since ARM's S1 came out, we saw Instacart, we saw Birkenstock. Is the IPO drought over at this point, Janae?
I think it's a little early to say. I think everyone wants to watch these tech stocks. You know, we run a $1 billion exit board. What we try to do is track the venture-backed companies that have the highest valuations that go out on the public markets. And we've seen a complete dearth in 2022. It was largely SPACs. And I think those deals were done in 2021. And then in 2023, things have completely dried up. And so I think this is really a testing to see of three very different companies. The companies we're really tracking is Instacart, Klaviyo, which is an email automation company, largely in the e-commerce space, and obviously the ARM listing. Three very, very different companies who are seeking to go out in September. And I think they each have very different stories to tell, but it'll be interesting for us to watch, is there investor appetite for each of these very different companies? How are they going to price in this market? And what do they look like 3 months to 6 months down the road? It's not only about the IPO and the IPO pop, but it's really about how these companies do in the markets in the months ahead, because we saw so many 2021 and 2020 and 2022 listings have gone down massively from their IPO price. Yeah, so Rivian. I think it's a test.
Yeah. One of the questions here as well is whether or not ARM is pitching itself as just like, we are an AI company, or whether it's doing something else and trying to talk about its fundamentals in some way. Janae, where do you see it's having the most success?
I think what's interesting about this IPO is that there is obviously it's coming out on the backdrop of NVIDIA, you know, and that stock going up massively. I think also as part of this IPO, there are a number of companies who want to invest in the IPO. I think Apple is one of them. There's a few others. So I think there's a lot of investor interest in the chip space right now in AI. There's certainly a huge demand. And what was interesting in looking at their IPO filing is year over year, revenue has been pretty flat. But I think their expectation, and I think Bloomberg reported this, that there is an expectation that in the next year, we're already into that because they just reported in March for fiscal 2023. But for the next year, they're expecting revenue to be up around 11% and then even higher than that in the year following. So I think they're anticipating a lot of demand for their chip designs. And so I think because of that, there is a lot of investor interest is based on growth for these companies, being profitable as companies, but also showing growth. And even though in the last fiscal year they haven't really shown revenue growth, I think there is expectation that they will going forward. Nonetheless, this price is still, you know, many are still saying it's a rich price.
Are you, how are you thinking about China's exposure, or excuse me, Arm's exposure to China? As we reported last month, Arm runs most of its China business through an independent unit called Arm Technology, which is its single largest customer, and accounted for about 24% of its sales in the year ended March. Does that raise any flags for you? And this isn't, you know, I mean, to be fair, I mean, Apple gets about 20% of its revenue each year from the greater China area. But I'm wondering how you think about that as an analyst.
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, there's so much demand for chips globally. China is a very, very big market. They've been investing in the space in order to create more independence. So I'm not quite sure what the outlook is for China, but certainly the demand globally is so big, and China is a very big market, but they are seeking to create some independence, although the Chinese market at this point is behind.
What if this IPO tomorrow doesn't go that well? I mean, I remember the Facebook experience back of 2012. Would it say something about AI? Would it say something about the IPO market? Speculate a little bit for us.
Yeah, I think it will definitely say something about both of those, about the AI market specifically and about the IPO market. I think the, you know, in going through this process and looking at these companies like Instacart, you know, Instacart is coming in way below even if its internal valuation set recently. I think Arm has been very careful. You know, we know that SoftBank bought its own shares at a $64 billion valuation just a month ago, and they're coming in, you know, almost $10 billion below that amount. So I think there is a lot of sensitivity in the market right now around pricing, partly because of how badly tech stocks have performed in the last 2 years. But I also think because for many of these investors in Instacart and in Arm and in Klaviyo, it's not really just about these three companies, it's the opening up of the markets, and it's the 10, 50, 100, some even say 200 companies who were looking at listing and were thinking about listing in 2021 and missed the mark. There might not be quite that many who could go out in this market or into 2024. But for many of those investors, it's about these companies that are going to be going out after these IPOs, and they don't want to price this too high and have that impact the markets. And, you know, interestingly, I spoke to a lawyer who worked on the Facebook IPO in 2012. There was so much anticipation around the Facebook IPO. It was priced at the highest level that it could. And the stock came down after it went public. The stock came down and kind of dampened the whole IPO market because it was such a big listing for about 9 months after that. And so I think given this is one of the biggest listings, certainly since 2021 when Rivian went public, I think investors are focused on Arm, but they're also focused on the next set of companies to come out and do not want the stock to collapse.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting you bring up Meta, you know, Facebook, now known as Meta Platforms, and Rivian, companies that have performed in completely different ways after hitting the public markets, Facebook's early problems notwithstanding. So I want to take a step back and just in the last 90 seconds we have with you, Janae, talk about a completely different stage of a company. And that's, of course, venture capital, way before the founders are even thinking about an IPO. You do a lot of analysis on the state of venture capital. Where are things right now in terms of fundraising and in terms of availability of funds?
Yeah, I think what we've seen is a huge pullback in the venture capital markets in 2022 from the second quarter and into 2023. And if you look back, 2020, there was north of $300 billion globally that went into private venture-backed companies from seed all the way through to late stage. In 2021, that doubled. It was north of $600 billion. And what we're seeing possibly for this year in the pullback, it's going to be half of that. It'll be less than $300 billion again. And I think the, you know, the late stage market has largely evaporated, and that's because of the IPO markets. If there aren't companies on a pipeline to go public, all of that money went in at the very late stage in anticipation of companies going public, and that did not happen. And so that massively pulled back, but ended up affecting actually every single stage pulled back as a result.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and you know, you point out that A lot of these companies have brought down their valuations here in this final stage. Janae Tier, Senior Data Editor at Crunchbase, thank you so much for your insight on this really momentous and interesting IPO coming out tomorrow.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, a few months ago, my brother sent me a TikTok. It just blew my mind. It was a demonstration of someone using Photoshop. I mean, okay, like that sounds, you know, why would I watch a TikTok of someone using Photoshop? Well, it started with a picture of a locker room with sports equipment was thrown everywhere. And then the person doing the demo was able to expand the borders of the image. And it seemed to magically grow to include other pieces of sporting equipment, more lockers. It just matched the scene perfectly. It actually looked like it was part of the original photo, even though it wasn't. It was a demonstration of the generative AI capabilities that Adobe, the maker of Photoshop, Illustrator, and more, has built into its full suite of products. Well, today, Adobe unveiling pricing for its new generative AI imaging tool, Firefly. It's going to cost less than OpenAI's competing service, DALL-E. And here to give us all the details is Anil Chakravathi, president of digital experience business at Adobe. He joins us on Zoom from San Jose, California. Anil, good to have you with us this afternoon. So we were talking about AI a lot throughout the program today, and I think a lot of the credit to the interest in AI has to go to OpenAI and ChatGPT just about a year ago. How long have you guys at Adobe been working on these generative AI capabilities?
Well, thanks for having me on the show. We've been working on AI, what we call Sensei, for well over 10 years. And the kind of example that you just shared in your lead-in, which we call generative fill, which is you take an image and then you can expand it and it'll fill it in for you. That is based on a set of generative AI technologies. It's really come together in the last 2 years or so. But we've put it all together with our knowledge of graphics, vision, all the expertise we have around imaging.
Yeah, Anil, I want to be clear as well. I have seen these TikToks or these reels, et cetera. They're amazing. I also initially thought I was going to see a really boring video, and it was very cool.
It's like a whole, they like go viral. It's like a whole thing if you type it into TikTok.
And you shared one this morning, yeah. Tim, one with an iguana. Yeah. You changed the setting. It's a forest. It's a beach. It's so cool. But what do people use this for? What's the commercial application here?
Yeah, the commercial applications, sorry, if you think of any big brand, and if you think of how much content they produce for their marketing requirements, and you think of a TV campaign that they run, or when you think of content that they run in their digital campaigns, all these personalized campaigns where they have small segments of audiences that they want to reach, they might want to reach them via email or through a mobile app or through social media. So there's a lot of content that gets produced by virtually every big brand around the world. And how they do it today is often it's a messy process. It's an expensive process. And they are not happy with, you know, how long it takes or the kind of content that they produce, because it needs to be on brand. It needs to reflect their values, but also it needs to be appealing and beautiful. And that's really what we've focused on, is how do you take this power of this generative AI technology around Firefly, make it available to marketers? And that's what we announced, a product called Gen Studio, for brands to be able to take advantage of all of this technology and open the power of content creation to everybody in their marketing departments.
One of the criticisms with AI has been, okay, well, a lot of what the generative AI relies on has been content created by people throughout the course of history, whether those are images, whether that is just text, in the case of ChatGPT, it's always citing something that was created by a person. How do you make sure in this product that people are getting credit for images that they produced?
Exactly. So, you know, that's one of the big areas of focus for Adobe right from the beginning. All of our products are designed to be commercially safe, which means that all of the training that we have done for Firefly and our generative AI technologies is with licensed content or content that's already in the public domain. And so that really enables us to be able to assure brands and marketers around the world that the content that's generated by this is commercially safe and they can use it in their campaigns. The other thing that we've done, and in fact, our general counsel, our chief trust officer spoke about it yesterday in Washington, is really focused on what we call FAIR, which is the federal anti-impersonation right, our support for making sure that artists get due credit for the intellectual property they have produced that then gets used to train these AI models. Hmm. That kind of transparency and making sure that there's benefit for everybody in the ecosystem is very important to us at Adobe.
Do you see AI products like this replacing the illustrators at Hollywood studios, for example? I mean, just considering the strikes that are going on there, do you see them replacing the graphic designers that a lot of these companies would hire to make this kind of content?
We see this AI as a co-pilot. We've often talked about the creative co-pilot that you get. This is, if you think of, for example, how Photoshop, in the example that you used, how that people would use it, usually they would start out with an image that they already had, and then they add layers to it, filters to it, and they make it more beautiful. So it's one way of starting the process is through this kind of generative AI, where you can say, you enter a prompt, it gives you a set of images, but then that's not the finished product. That's what you start with. And then the artist or the creative professional then goes on to use our tools to make it on brand or make it much more visually appealing. So it's really the starting point. It's an iterative process, and that's why it's really a co-pilot. It is not a replacement.
Anil, I always like to ask people who are in your position what they visualize 5-10 years down the road. I mean, what we're seeing right now is pretty cool, and like I described it, it is mind-blowing. But if you could snap your fingers and create a product or create a feature, what does that look like?
You know, 5-10 years down the road, when you think of how brands produce content, content will be individualized, personalized, the right content at the right time for every individual. Today, when companies or brands produce content, usually they produce a one hero asset, for example, as they call it, and then they use it in every campaign. They won't need to do that. You know, if you look out a few years from now, what they'll be able to do is produce beautiful content that's really personalized and appealing to every single individual. So if you and I are seeing a campaign from a brand, we might be seeing completely different images, completely different videos, but it'll be personalized to us, and that'll be made possible through this technology.
Anil, thanks so much for taking the time and joining us this afternoon, especially on such a busy day for Adobe. That's Anil Chakravathy, President of Digital Experience Business at Adobe, joining us on Zoom from San Jose, California.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, it's hard to believe it's already that time of year when Bloomberg Business Week unveils the Business Week B-School rankings. This is an assessment of 110 full-time graduate MBA programs around the globe. It's based on data provided by participating schools, as well as responses to survey questions by students, alumni, and employers. The surveys gauge the participants' level of satisfaction with learning, networking, career opportunities, skill development, and more. The person who has the Herculean task of putting this all together each year is Dimitra Kesanidis, senior editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. She joins us here in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. You can read Dimitra's story on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com/Businessweek. And look for it next week in Bloomberg Magazine, Bloomberg Businessweek Magazine, excuse me. Also with us is Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. Joel, in our business, they call an introduction like that bearing the lead. So come on.
5 straight years.
Again?
Yeah.
Again?
Yeah, they've done it again. What's in the water out there, Dimitra?
Something very special. Yeah. Lots of money.
Money. That's true. Don't choke on the water.
The thing that makes you make money, create businesses. No, I mean, we're joking. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of really important stuff that happens in a place that's right next to Palo Alto, that's in Silicon Valley, that's next to big tech companies and startups and entrepreneurs, and whatever the hits are that those industries have taken this past year, it still really matters to a lot of people out there. And it's just top class. So they are doing something right at Stanford.
So we do this every year. We've done this for many years, Business Week has.
Yes, 36 years.
Who's counting? And what's amazing is it's all survey-based, right? So walk us through a little bit of the methodology about what goes into this so that eventually we have a ranking and in this particular instance, Stanford comes out on top. And then we'll talk about some of the other schools.
It's survey-based and it's data is submitted-based. B-schools are required to submit a lot of data to other entities out there that deal with, like, compensation and various other things, jobs and such. We require some of that same information from schools about the composition of their classes and how much they're earning when they get out, how many students they have, and so on and so forth. And then at the same time, the key people that we think are most important in this whole universe are the recent grads or current students that are about to graduate, alumni over the past 10 or so years, different classes, and employers. And we ask them, you know, different questions to gauge whether they're satisfied with what they're learning in class, whether they think they're really being exposed to the kind of networking that you expect to get when you go to business school. That's a major one. You know, and then they also weigh in on some of the other factors that we get the data from the schools on, and that all combines in a magical way with the work of Tim. You mentioned that I have the Herculean task. I am not alone.
I thought you
Herculean
did it all
task.
Yourself.
We have an amazing team, and the data visualization team and the two analysts that are primarily responsible for this, Alex McIntyre and Matt Benamu, are the ones that really, like, pull that all together in a way that gives us this fantastic list.
Still Herculean.
Are you just saying their names so they get hate mail too? Instead of just you getting the hate mail?
I'm hoping, yes.
From Chicago, Dartmouth, and Virginia.
Okay, exactly. Well, let's get to those other schools, right?
Yeah.
So who else?
Well, we've seen some consistencies. You know, somebody just asked me a few minutes ago, like, come on, don't the schools, like, isn't it the same every year? And I'm like, no, it's not the same every year. I mean, Stanford's the same for 5 years, but 6 years ago, it wasn't Stanford. We have the University of Virginia this year jumped quite a bit because its recent alumni reported starting, you know, salaries. And so their median starting salary was significantly higher, like almost $30,000 higher than what had been reported by survey takers last year and the year before. Compensation does matter to people who go to business school. Might not be the primary factor, but it's an important one. You're going to pay all that money. You're going to do all that time for 2 years. You want to earn some good money. You want to pay back your student loans. You want to just know you're going to be okay. So UVA did very well this year. Several other schools moved up. Columbia moved up some. UC Berkeley, Haas moved up. You know, you see across the board there are different factors that are boosting those scores, whether it has to do, again, with the satisfaction they feel they got because of the job outcomes that worked out for them or the comp, or really sincerely feeling like they were just exposed to fantastic classes, teachers, learning, and research. And, you know, from year to year, that's what changes. And you do, you might not see it at the very top of the list or maybe even at the very bottom, but you see movement in the list that's meaningful.
Is there one category that really sets Stanford apart as opposed consistently?
We've seen, you know, we have these five key indexes, and they're, you know, compensation, learning, networking. Entrepreneurship is the one that year in, year out, they are coming in first on among all the schools that we survey. And again, that's not surprising, right? Given where they are, given the part of the country they're in, the industry that they're very closely aligned with, it's an important one for them.
Okay, the other thing to keep in mind here is that this isn't just a U.S. ranking.
It is not. It is an international ranking. Yes. Now, we don't produce a global list, by the way, just to clarify. Sometimes people think, oh, well, how come there's not one list with all the schools? Certain factors, like our diversity index, is really only for U.S. schools. Mm. The way that we're able to measure that is not something we can apply to the international schools. The minute you introduce something like that, then you can't really mix and match all the scores and say, well, what's the big long list? We look at schools in Europe. Very strong, healthy market for business education. Europe, we know, right, the INSEADs of the world, but there are schools that are up and coming that are doing great, like the number one school in Europe this year, Bocconi, which is a big school in Milan, Italy. You see lots of schools in Spain. So our Europe rankings are part of this, our Asia rankings, which are growing. We're really pushing because there's been a push that we know, it's not reflected in how many schools we have yet, but like India, another very healthy market for business education, and then Canada. So that's what we've got. Well,
each year we do a broadcast from the number one business school in the U.S. We've been to Stanford for the past few years, but Joel, we haven't been to Milan.
Oh, let's go. There's the ask.
I'm just wondering if we're going to do an international broadcast this year.
You can put a ticket in. Just don't subscribe me to it. We'll see.
That's internal parlance for don't bother me about it, but ask someone else.
Yeah. I think I'll join you on that ticket.
I'm in.
I have a little bit of Italian. I can draw on that. We'll be good. We'll be good.
It's funny. I can already see it like being like an extended stay. Like we'll have to do a little dispatch and some research.
We have to figure out why the business community there is so successful for these graduates, of course.
Milan, there you Prada, go. Gucci, you know, fashion, Italian style and design. And it's not all that, actually. No, it's not, though. Lots of manufacturing, lots of consumer jobs. Technology also coming out of schools like that. So, you know, there are both the things you might immediately recognize in a place like Milan. And then if you stop and you pull back, you know, there are others that you might be a little surprised by. But
okay, so the whole point of doing an MBA is that maybe it opens some doors that wouldn't otherwise open. You have a new appreciation about how business works. You get some skills. Mm-hmm. What do people do when they graduate?
They do lots of different things. What do you mean by jobs?
Yeah, what industries are they going to?
I mean, you know,
how is that changing?
We have been on the story this year on jobs, and we all know this. Jobs have been tough this year. We know what's going on in the tech sector and what was going on really in the beginning of the year into the second quarter and beyond. The consulting, so the top three industries are finance, consulting, and tech. Finance had, you know, challenging industry this year, cutbacks, contraction. Consulting, same thing. Consulting, unheard of in the past, started pulling back start dates and maybe even contemplating pulling back job offers. We have lots of students that we were in touch with on various questions where we have a back and forth. They give us their emails to just communicate and clarify answers. There were lots of responses and there were lots of things that were shared with us about the degree to which the consulting firms really had spooked lots of business school students across the country with jobs. And technology, of course. But, you know, the upside is we're seeing that at the same time that we're seeing a lot of new and interesting opportunities emerge. And AI is very scary for people, or something like ChatGPT, which, you know, dominated the conversation, but it's not the only thing. The healthcare industry has a lot going on. There's a lot going on, actually, in consumer goods and even in media and entertainment. So there are ways in which the jobs are going to start to evolve, I think. I don't think we're ever going to knock those three off the top three perches, you know, finance, consulting, and technology. But I think that the way that MBAs are taking the education, applying it, incorporating aspects of, you know, climate change and how they're going to manage through challenging periods like what we see it every day in the news. I think the kinds of jobs are evolving and becoming just richer and more about, like, it's not just that you lead a company. You lead a company in this world, in these challenging times, with many people that work for you who have very different needs and what have you. So, you know, it's becoming a much, it's just many more pieces to it.
Well, I guess one of the questions people ask is, do you need to go to business school? Because I think there's this thought that, you know, a lot of the results you're going to get from it are the people you're with, potentially.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And it's interesting to see we break down the learning component of these rankings. And you'll notice that with the exception of Virginia, the other ones in the top five are not there. William & Mary, Georgia, Maryland, Georgia Tech are actually the top four. What would you say to someone who's saying, I don't know that I'm necessarily going to learn very much from business school, and why are these folks doing it better, maybe even than the top dogs?
You know, I don't know that they're necessarily doing it better. I think respondents from those schools are giving them higher marks because it's just an area that isn't really dominating kind of the ethos and the discussion as much at the school in question. I think it's very simplistic to say that you're not going to learn something at business school. There are a lot of things you can learn at business school today. When you really get into a school and just go and spend some time talking to people about the way their curriculum has evolved, how science is entering into it, the interdisciplinarity of it and all, there's a great deal that's changing and that you can really learn if you want to take advantage of it. It might not be for you, depending on what your goals are. Are you very happy in the job that you have right now? Do you see a path forward that doesn't require you to step off the path and maybe get some more education? Are you achieving compensation-wise what you want? Or are you at a point where you're really ready for a big change? You always thought you had the makings of a manager or a leader of a business. You want to start your own company. So you have to really examine very carefully what you want. And there are so many ways that business schools today then are tailoring their programs. We measure full-time MBA programs, but what you're seeing is there's a drop-off in applications, and there's a concern about enrollment in these programs too. And there are a lot of reasons for it. And one of the reasons is because coming out of the pandemic, but even earlier, there are many ways that you sitting in your job, I, Demetra, could decide, hey, I'm gonna ask Bloomberg to assign me to a different beat so there's no conflict, because I'd like to go to business school, but I don't want to give up my job. Mm. And I love this program at UCLA, but I don't live in Los Angeles, but you know what? I can do it remotely. And in 3 years, I can have a specialization in something that is really going to move me in a direction in whichever industry it is that I think is going to, you know, be most sort of suitable for me. And there's a lot of that happening. Data analytics is the most popular specialization in business school programs right now. So it's those kinds of things. And you have to look beyond just like full-time MBA 2 year, which is what we measure, okay. But there's a lot going on in ways that can really enhance what somebody is going to do.
I think one question you'd have to ask yourself, Simone, is how much do you like partying and trips to Cancun? Because that was a big part of my business school experience, as it gets further and further in the rear view.
There are great parties and networking opportunities.
The parties are ridiculous. Demetra, we only have about a minute left, but I want to talk about that diversity index here. It's not new this year necessarily, but there are parts of it that are new. Talk a little bit about just the rankings there and lack of overlap between the top 10s or what you're seeing.
It continues to be a challenging area. It's tough to say a lot right now because I think there's a lot also that we're not quite clear on how it's going to evolve for the schools that are going to be most directly affected by the Supreme Court decision, the affirmative action decision. You know, some schools, like California schools, for example, will not be affected. So it's really tough. What I can say is that schools are very concerned. Schools have been very focused on trying and working at. It's a tough nut to crack. I historically, you know, used to work covering big law firms. I think that there's a ways to go. We're going to keep doing our index. We're going to keep trying to build on that. And schools are going to have to find a way to really kind of level the playing field, I guess, and open it up to more.
Demetra Kasanidis at Bloomberg Business Week and Joel Weber, the editor of the magazine. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Hard to believe we're already there. Just shy of 18 minutes until the close of U.S. markets here. Yes, I should say U.S. equity markets. We're very pleased to have back with us Amanda Agati, Chief Investment Officer at PNC Asset Management Group. She joins us once again on Zoom from Philadelphia. Amanda, whenever you join us, I always think of the 12 days of Christmas that you guys do each and every year. But it's fall. It's not winter yet. So we're not quite there yet, are we?
We're not quite there, but we're starting the work to put the analysis together. So it's going to be here before we know it.
Okay.
We're talking about back to school shopping, but we'll be ready for the holiday shopping season just a few short months.
Okay, that sounds good. In the meantime, what do things look like in the markets between now and then when it comes to equities and when it comes to fixed income?
We think it's going to be kind of a choppy second half here. I think if you think about all of 2023, we really feel like it's going to be very different in the second half, almost a tale of two halves. I think, you know, based on what you're seeing today in terms of the CPI report coming in a little hotter than expected, a little bit of an acceleration there, that's kind of setting the tone for what we're likely to see in the balance of the year here. We think the market's just going to continue to be a little choppy, if not range bound, until we can get a little bit of clarity on some of the trajectory of key data points to tell us whether we're heading for that soft landing or we're just going to power right through that no landing scenario.
Were there any bits and pieces of today's CPI report that really stood out to you, one of the things that Stuart Paul, our U.S. economist here at Bloomberg Economics, was saying was new car prices were his. What's yours?
Well, we certainly saw rents move in the right direction, aka a bit lower. We're seeing a little bit of a frothiness come out of auto. So that's great to see. But there's still a lot of stickiness on the services side of the equation. It's notorious in terms of being sticky here. And so, you know, I think for us, it's not necessarily one data point that's confirming a trend. I think we need to see a few more of these CPI reports of a similar tone overall, that the stickiness is here and that there's still a little bit of acceleration likely ahead. But I think the CPI reports are just going to continue to be a little choppy here. I don't think that this one data point confirms what the Fed should do next. We don't think that they're going to take action at the September meeting, but I do think there's still potentially at least one more rate hike in play. We're not at the Fed's long-term target, so they still have plenty of ammo to take another step if they feel like they need to.
Are you concerned that they have over-tightened or they could over-tighten?
Well, we're certainly in restrictive territory from a policy perspective. There's no question that financial conditions are tight here. But I think what's surprising is that the consumer's hanging in there. We're starting to see some weakness. We're starting to see a little bit in terms of cracks around consumer behavior. But labor market continues to be strong. Wage growth is on a real tear here, even with a lagged effect. So there's still a decent amount of underlying strength, even as growth overall is slowing here. And so I don't think we can talk too much about policy error or misstep just yet, because we're still, you know, in positive, though decelerating growth territory. I think the question is much more not whether they take one more step to tighten policy or not, but how long they keep rates at these fairly restrictive levels. We continue to say we're in a longer for longer dynamic. This whole process is just going to take a lot longer than what any of us investors would like to see. And so I think that's probably more important for the market's path forward than whether it's one hike in the balance of the year or not.
You guys mentioned back to school just a few seconds ago. What are you seeing with back to school?
Well, I guess we're going to get a pretty important retail sales report tomorrow. So I guess I could tell you more after I see that report. But I think it's going to be a very important indicator for the health of the consumer and what, you know, consumer behavior, consumption trends look like. I think we're seeing a pretty significant shift away from a lot of big ticket discretionary spending. That's not new news. We've been on that trend for a while. But I think more recently, we're starting to see the more consumer staples, you know, essentials be the area of focus. And then I think the wild card that's not getting a ton of attention out there is student loan payments coming back online here. It's going to put a lot of pressure on consumers at a time where they're already feeling the pinch.
Well, could that have the effect of doing the Fed's work for it?
Oh, absolutely. It could. Yes. Yes. And we do think that it will. And we also think that all of the Fed policy tightening that we've seen so far hasn't fully been borne out in the economy here, that there's this long lagged effect. And so some of it certainly is having an impact, but there's still a decent amount of room to go. And that's why I'm saying at the end of the day, what matters most is how long they keep rates at these levels as to what happens with the market's path forward and certainly whether we ultimately tip into contraction or not. But that's an underappreciated risk, certainly. The student loan payment, you know, situation as it relates to consumers, very much an underappreciated risk going into the balance of the year.
Yeah, I'm really interested in this. So talk a little bit about where the risks are and who would see the result of those payments increasing, apart from the people who have to pay those student loans back.
Well, I think it's just a general pressure on the U.S. consumer in general. I mean, 70% of consumption, and 70% of GDP growth and GDP-related activity in this country is tied to consumption. And so the consumer's been the lifeline over the course of the cycle and in but much better shape given how late in the innings we are this time around relative to past cycles. And so this, you know, student loan debt coming back online, these payments coming due, is hitting very, very late in the innings. And so I think it does have the potential to zap a lot of consumer health here and may put the brakes on consumer spending and consumer behavior much faster than I think what the market's no landing scenario is pricing for this year.
We've only got about a minute left, but how do you position for the coming environment, this longer for longer scenario that you've described?
Well, we have been leaning very hard into quality exposures all year, which has certainly served us well. But in general, we've been very focused on running a defensive playbook. To us, that doesn't mean raising a ton of cash and moving to the sidelines. It's staying very well diversified, leaning into quality, as I said, not taking big bets, staying pretty close to longer term strategic targets. And then what we haven't really talked about too much is what's going on the fixed income side. We're absolutely dialing back a lot of below investment grade credit oriented exposures. In this environment, investors aren't being paid to take on that kind of risk at these credit spread levels. And so leaning on that side of the equation into investment grade as well.
Amanda Agati, we love it when you join us. And we got to come back at least one time between now and the holidays to give us an update on how you're looking at the rest of the year until we do get to the end of the year. Hard to believe it's already September. Talking about. around Christmas.
Maybe for Halloween or something.
Yeah, spooky. Amanda Gotti's Chief Investment Officer at PNC Asset Management Group, joining us once again on Zoom from Philadelphia. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.